This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome, John Krishna Bush, to my Awakening Now podcast on Ram Dass's Be Here Now network. And it's wonderful to see you, as always, my dear old friend, since 1970 or 71. And we didn't really prepare for this discussion, but there's a lot to talk about. We've prepared, I think, for the last 5 years, 40, if I can still 40, do math. Yeah,
45 years.
So it's unbelievable. Welcome. and welcome, everybody. Lama Surya Das here, Awakening Now podcast. John Krishna Bush is a filmmaker, Direct Pictures. He's well known for the award-winning Yatra trilogy. Yatra is a Sanskrit word, Indian language word, for pilgrimage. And he's a photographer and graphic artist and writer and bhakti devotee and long time, probably 45 or more, 50 years meditator and a spiritual seeker and finder also. He's a wise elder. And he's a mentor to me, actually. He introduced me to Maharaji Nim Karoli Baba, my first guru, Ram Dass's guru, Krishnadas's guru, Krishna Bush's guru here, Mirabai Bush's guru. Many of our friends are with him. And John Krishna, I call him Krishna, introduced me, and I'm always grateful to that. And he's a wonderful, dear friend, and two of his sons are my godchildren. So, Krishna, welcome. How are you, and what are you up to these days?
It's lovely to meet you in this way, Surya.
Isn't it?
We've never done this.
We've never Skyped together, even.
But yeah. Over a 45-year friendship, anything is possible.
Yes, yeah, starting off in India, even though we were both at the University of Buffalo in the 60s, and we've been in monasteries and ashrams together and on pilgrimage, yatra, together. And aren't you working on a film now? Weren't you shooting in India and Himalayas in the last couple of years?
Yeah, no, I've been working on it for the last 3 years. I'm going to just take out one of these earbuds here. Yes, it's another pilgrimage film, a feature-length film, shot entirely in India. And in this time, we're on a pilgrimage that goes from the very northern part of India in Badrinath, which is one of the four holy sites, to the southern tip of India, to Rameshwaram, which again is one of the major tirthas at each of the four directions. So this one, we're going from the northern tirtha to the southern tirtha. Tirthas are places of passage. I know these are things you know, Suri. I'm just saying this for the benefit of other people who may be listening.
Yes, absolutely. So Badrinath is way in the north in the Himalayas, and it's a holy cave. Tirtha, sacred place. And the other one is at the tip of the subcontinent, so it's almost the southernmost part. So you're going to span the whole continent that way from north to south?
Right. That's exactly what the film goes on, a cinematic pilgrimage to about 18 different locations. Each of them considered what's called a tirtha in Hinduism, mm-hmm. which is a place of passage, mm-hmm. Sort of a hot spot, if you will.
A sacred site.
Yeah, sacred site, something that yogis
a pilgrimage place
over the last few thousand years have figured is sort of a good spot to do practice or to do right. something. And then, you know, then it later became there are temples that arose around it, and then it became a, you know, a pilgrimage location.
Right. So there's a lot of good juju put in there and in the air, imbuing the whole atmosphere from thousands of years of yogis and swamis and meditators and devotees and lovers of the divine and seekers coming there like other holy places in the world. And I know your yatra trilogy, your pilgrimage trilogy, covered Southeast Asia, covered Tibet and Himalayas, and covered India. So that's a lot to enjoy if anyone's interested in that. By the way, if you can see this on video, the beautiful art piece behind John Krishnabush is one of his works. So he's a wonderful, he has a wonderful eye, and he's a graphic artist. He had a business called Illuminations, a right livelihood business employing his spiritual satsang family in the, with Mirabai Bush, his wife at the time, in the 70s, 80s, and it became Millennium in the 90s. And he's a real artist and has a great eye. But he's a sacred artist, and he's made art is a big part of your path, isn't it? Can you talk about that a little bit, how we can mingle our vocation with our art form, even if it's not recognized as art, you know, the art of living or whatever we do, our work, our vocation in life and the spiritual path?
Yeah. Well, I know when I was making the film Prajna Earth, we were in Bali. And, you know, the Balinese culture is completely aesthetic oriented. Everything is ritualized and, you know, special garments for this and for that and all these extraordinary painting and wood carving and all this stuff. And yet they don't have a word in their language for art, you know, because it's just really? Considered life mm-hmm. that you're creating your life
every day,
you know, and
yeah.
you're creating your spiritual life. So I find that that's, you know, we've kind of cloistered art to museums or to, you know, galleries
a
in
few
Chelsea
people
or
called artists.
Yeah. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes. Fine.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I just, you know, I feel, you know, we're basically creating our lives. So everybody is in the tent that way, as far as being an artist is concerned. I mean, we all make artistic choices almost at every turn in our life, what we want to do, how we want to, what we want to think, what we want to say, you know, what we want
yes.
to create.
You know? It's all creative expression, and we're part of the creation and also, dare I say, the creator. Dare
True
I
enough.
Say. We're all part of that. So, you know, as you know, writing and poetry is very important to me. That's my art form besides teaching and, you know, envisioning positive futures and community activities and so on. What do you think about sacred art? And, you know, you've gone from Illuminations to modern media to film and so on. And how do you, one, bring forth the sacred, which is so ancient and timeless, in this very secular, postmodern, materialistic, high-tech, scientistic era? And also, how do you stretch the boundaries of art? As you said, everyone's in the tent because we're all creating our lives every day and every moment. And everything we do and move is creative expression, almost like dance. So how do you stretch those boundaries and still and inspire people?
Well, I think the difference between, say, commercial art or what I'm doing is that there's an aspect of the eternal in what I'm doing. I mean, in other words, what I'm trying to convey to the viewer is an atmosphere of the eternal, you know, which resonates with that part of themselves that is eternal. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing in the work. I mean, you know, I mean, I try to keep a minimum of speaking. I mean, you know, I try to have like maybe a minute of speaking and with 2 minutes of just music or ambient sound or things like this. So somebody can allow the, so the viewer can allow this to come inside for them, you know, so that they can take it in. But actually, I'm not sure I'm answering your question specifically. So ask
That's
me a little
okay.
bit
we're
more.
That's okay. We're just, you know, talking. I'm thinking about how we're all part of the creation and the creator and the creative process, and how we can stretch the boundaries. Like for me, starting off with writing and poetry and prose and songs, and then trying to stretch beyond to like haiku, one-liners, words of wisdom, using foreign words and phrases that people know as part of it, and chanting. You know, I have chant CDs and I'm always leading chanting and doing chanting every day as part of my own practice. Mm-hmm. So then everything, walking and playing with the dog or, you know, singing to the child while they're going to sleep, it all becomes part of what I would call being a poet and a writer.
Yeah, you certainly are. Look how prolific you are. I mean, it's obviously a complete way of life for you. I mean, as well as being a spiritual teacher, I mean, one of your main vehicles for doing that is through your writing. Mm-hmm. And how many books have you written now?
I have 14 published books.
That's remarkable. I mean, that's really a lot of work. I mean, anybody who's written knows how much work that is, you know? And it's amazing. But the way I think you're able to do that, Suri, is because you are a poet. I mean, you understand that being a poet isn't something that's not just an ivory towerism or some way
academic,
of something academic. It's really a way of seeing, you know, the dance of life. Yeah. I mean, to really, you know, to touch the causal levels of reality. As a poet, you know, and that was my background too at mm-hmm. Buffalo. I was teaching, I was studying with a lot of really great poets. And that was a thing at the time, was really to think of oneself as a poet, you know, and not just that you're somebody, a published poet or something mm-hmm. like that, but just
that you're writing poetry and seeing things poetically.
You were working yeah. and everything in your life was feeding into it. Mm-hmm. It was completely integrated. It wasn't, you know, and it was more just seeing the aesthetics also in life, you know, the aesthetics and the mystery and, the romance, all of it, to really be open to that. And, you know, I think it's one of the reasons why people like binge watching television so much is that they, you know, for many hours, they're kind of immersed into that sort of other world.
The magic.
Magic
of some kind.
Projection. Yeah. Right. So, it's interesting. I hadn't put that together before, but yeah, I think that's the difference. I mean, you know, if you're really just in the commercial realm as a writer, you know, you may not write 14 books, but you really had something to say. You had something to share. It was like mm-hmm. a vision that you're still getting out
yeah.
into the world. And, you know, I just admire it so much. I've known you for so long. Just as I have a chance to say that, you know.
Well, thank you. Well, you're pretty prolific too. You know, with your art and your community activism and work and now your films and other things. Of course, also your family, your three sons, et cetera. Now, you know, your granddaughter, and that's also a creation. I see an art or, I don't know, my writing, let's say. Writing, for me, writing and teaching and living are a seamless whole. So I don't know if I don't want to say I'm always writing in my head like I'm thinking that way and then I got to go write it down. But, you know, seeing the aesthetics or it's a way of seeing, of awakening now and being. Seeing and being goes together.
Yeah, well, you know,
with that vision.
It's getting, I think it means getting out of the subject-object mm-hmm. world and mm-hmm. just becoming part of the
part
experience,
of
you know,
yeah.
where you're not just looking at objects. I think, you know, artists do, there are artists who just see things as objects, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, they have, has a certain audience. But the true artist, I mean, they're not separate from what they're capturing or seeing or writing, you know.
So, since you said that, you know, I lived in Japan 1 year in Kyoto in the 70s, studying Zen and teaching English, of course, to live, but also studying haiku with Sid Corman, a well-known poet, American poet there, and other people. And I remember the great haiku poet Basho. He said, "To write a haiku about a tree, first, I look at the tree and look at the tree long enough until there's only the tree." In other words, it's not, there's no me looking at the tree. He doesn't even say I become one with the tree. That's a little ego activity. Just there's only the tree. Then, this is a quote, then a haiku can be written. He doesn't say then I can write a haiku.
Yeah.
Then a haiku can happen.
That was my ongoing koan with Suzaki Roshi was how do you realize God looking at a pine tree? You
know,
so I had a permutation of that. But ultimately, it was that breakthrough that I was talking about. Was again, it's not becoming one with the tree, because then again, that's still some level of identification, right?
Yeah.
But it was you know, just not being separate from it, just not separate.
Yes. You know? Beyond ideas like two or one, even. Or none.
So I think as far as a poet is concerned, I mean, if we can talk in that sort of heroic term, that's willing to take those risks, willing to really see beyond the apparent, you know. And I think that's an invitation for everyone. Just as we were saying, everyone is an artist, everyone is a poet, everybody has that in them, and that everybody's given that same koan to solve in their life. So they're going to keep looking at it in lots
of ways. How do I realize God or truth while doing and fill in the blank, whatever you're doing right now, we're doing right now.
Yeah.
That same very elder senior Japanese Zen master who lived the second half of his life in L.A., Suzaki Roshi, he's gone now, but I think he lived to 102 or 104. God bless his soul.
104.
Yeah. He gave me the koan.
He was teaching.
I know. Unbelievable.
I mean, I can't believe you have a Zen master who's like over 100 years old.
Yeah, and I don't think he was doing it by health foods and exercise.
No, and Leonard was his young, Leonard Cohen, you know, was his young student, right? And right. Leonard's, what, how old is Leonard now? 85?
He must be 80, yeah. He's getting up there. Well, Suzaki Roshi, he gave you the koan. How do I realize God while... Looking at a pine tree. Yeah. He gave me the koan in the 70s in Boulder when I went to a session, you know, a week-long meditation intensive, residential intensive with him. He gave me the koan. How do I realize God while driving car? Which is kind of more modern, you know?
Yeah,
like now we have to say, and I'll put it to you. How do I realize
Zafu for like 13 hours a day. I was much rather be thinking of a pine tree than a car.
Right. That's what I'm trying to bring it into the daily life. Like, how do we realize God using the computer?
That's the beginner level pine tree. You got the sort of intermediate koan, right?
Yeah, probably. So now I'm thinking, how do we realize God while using the computer or the handheld device or, you know, making a film? Does technology interfere? It's just one more tree that has grown in the, you know, in quote, God's creation. That's part of, you know, how do we realize God while
a big part of my world
doing our life?
Because it's so simple writing, you know, at some level. I mean, you can really just do it with a piece of coal, you know. I mean, you know, you need to.
Or your finger.
But to the stuff that I'm involved in now, it's like so complicated.
Yes.
And technology. And I have to learn it continually, you know, but because it's also changing continually. But it does keep my mind sharp. So in that sense, I mean, it really keeps my mind from drifting too far off course, because I got to really pay attention to all that tech stuff, you know?
Well, that's the zen of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Doing what you're doing 100% while you're doing it. Kind of like uber mindfulness, the opposite of mindlessness. I love writing and, you know, the arts also, because it awakens me and it helps me to be more present. Sometimes I'm inspired and it feels like communing with the muse, but that's just an overlay. What it really means is I'm not my usual self or mental preoccupations, and just present and accountable or accounted for, and just doing what I'm doing 100% while I'm doing it. And that's an unbelievable, harmonious, and delightful feeling. Of course, meditation and other things, I like that because I can bring you to that. But exercise or being with people you love, in so many ways we can realize God, to use the agnostic, the non-theistic Zen master's language. Thank God for the Buddhism. That's what I always say. Even though it's not. Thank God for the Dharma.
Good safe hangout for the agnostics out there.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I have to say, I was riding. I was coming back from the dentist this morning on the Upper East Side, and I was coming down to where my studio is here in the, you know, at the end of the island, the other side. And so I was riding on the one train for about 20 minutes
in Manhattan.
just reflecting about what a rolling zendo the subway is. I mean, you know, and I always have this feeling when I'm on the car. I've had it for as long as I've been in New York. I get on the subway, I sit down, everybody's sitting completely, you know, upright, silent, you know, not saying a word, looking forward. It's just, I mean,
like
you might as well be
meditation.
A zendo, except, you know, people, and everybody really is sort of chilling, you know, so I mean, there's something to that, but I like it because it's sort of it's the Mahayana, it's the greater vehicle, right? Right there
it's
on the
inclusive.
Subway, car after car of people sitting there, you know. And
going in the same direction.
Going in the same direction.
For once.
It's a wonderful thing. I love riding the subway in New York. It's always a thrill for me. I mean, and I do it, you know, a lot.
I used to do it when I was younger, of course, and grew up near New York and even knew the subway because my father used it a lot to go to work and all. So sometimes I went with him, but I love this image of everybody on this going the same way and on the path in the subway. I know there's even the path train to New Jersey.
But everybody's silent. That's. I mean, how often does that happen? Maybe
right, never.
Theater, you know.
Yeah.
But
right.
But everybody's silent, and people, you know, maybe they're fidgeting with their phones or stuff like that. But people are pretty, you know, straight on, looking ahead. Right. I mean, it's
focused,
unmistakable. Some form of collective. Contemplation going on there.
Co-meditation. I'm enjoying this image. I could see a cartoon in this. I could make a cartoon. By the way, we were talking about stretching beyond the division between sacred and secular in our art form. So, and you were talking about me putting out books. So I have a collection now with a collaborator of Karmatoons, original cartoons that we've made. And I'm thinking about what to do with them.
So, oh, really? I've seen
that's
a few of
the opposite of poetry.
Yeah, yeah.
But
well,
it's,
I'm just
saying, stretching the medium, seeing things at a different angle and giving, you know, awakening to a new way of seeing and being. And humor, of course, and levity can so help us get out of our head.
Great. I'd love to see you do that.
So, you know, even yesterday we came up with 6 more ideas that we have to draw and caption. But I'm loving this idea of people, everybody going in the same direction on the path or the path train, to exaggerate, in New York, and especially in this season of electile dysfunction. It doesn't seem like in this country we're all going in the same direction.
That's funny.
That's the title
of
a new book.
Glad when this is over. It's taking up way too much of my mind and the mind of everyone I know. It's like
the blue dress. It's never
it's
ending.
Sort of like living inside, it's one of the great Hindu epics or something like that.
Yes, like the Mahabharata goes on forever.
The Devi slaying the monster. It's really, it's pretty, it's epic. I mean, it really is.
And and it's hard to distinguish fact from fiction, from fantasy, from madness, you know.
Yeah. Anyway, I think it's good though. I'm really happy that, you know, that there's such a dialogue going on about so many things at this point that are, you know, usually aren't talked about, that people are just too polite to even bring up.
And, like men and women?
Never really gets looked at.
Like that dynamic of men and women that's come out in sort of an ugly way, but at least not a violent way, an abusive way. But there's a huge dialogue now in the country because of that this very month and this very fall. So that's one little silver lining.
Yeah, that's
in this
a long overdue conversation. I mean, I'm surprised still 2016.
I know.
Really just beginning that conversation.
I know.
I mean,
it's hard to believe. Crazy, you know? It's already moved so far past that with the gay revolution and LBQ, you know, and all the rest.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a beautiful
thing.
I think
once things get connected to human rights, then it takes on a whole nobleness, like it did it, like when that with same-sex marriage, that became a human rights issue. And in that context, you couldn't deny the reality of it. I mean, you can really tell other people who they can love or who they can marry? No, of course not, you know. And it seems to be the same here. It seems to be that now it's like no man has the right to regard women in that way or, you know, and to act on it, you know. And that's sort of like, I don't know. I mean, you know, we're coming from an older time, from sort of the Mad Men time, at least in my case. I was alive then, you know, so I've watched these attitudes change over the years, you know, but there's still a lot of changing that has to happen, that's for sure.
Yes, and I hope we're all working on that and thinking about that and working together on systemic change, not just short-term, you know, voting, which is important, but See, I don't think this is going to end just because somebody gets elected.
You can miss them by having a, if you have a, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut over you.
Yeah, let me finish my thought, thanks. I don't think that, you know, everybody I know, and I hear myself saying, I can't wait for this to end, but it's not going to end just because somebody gets elected or even inaugurated till we change the broken systems that we have and, you know, the impacted Congress and Senate that doesn't let anything happen. Only votes on partisan lines, not according to issues and values. And, you know, the other problems we have with education and racism and so many poverty and inequality in this country, in this world. So we have to keep working on this.
It sort of comes from a lot of the same sources, though. I absolutely agree with you, you know, by the way.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true. But I think there's, you know, what we're seeing now is a lot of the portraying of the other, right? Of
yes.
the immigrant, of, you know, of, you know, Black Lives Matter people or, mm-hmm. you know, women, nasty women or whatever it is that that sort of seems to scare people, you know. But, you know, at least it's being looked at. We're seeing it's all
yes.
comes from that.
It's coming into the light. Yeah.
I have to say one of the things, again, I'm sorry to keep talking about, well, you're a
no,
New
no.
Yorker.
You Go
know
ahead.
What I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, like here, the experiment's long been over as far as, you know, mm-hmm. immigrants and different, you know,
yes.
the diversity reality and stuff right. like that. It's wonderful. It's the most wonderful thing about the city, about New York, is it's just such a, everybody is here and everybody's a New Yorker. You know,
yes, I've heard that.
Even if you're an illegal immigrant.
Right.
You're still a New Yorker.
That's part of it. That's,
New Yorker. So
that's a tradition.
A feeling that way,
yeah,
you know?
Right. It's a tradition to be an illegal immigrant and bring your people over and work hard.
Yeah, I know.
Off the books and try to get your kids legal and go to, you know, educational advancement and all. And there are street signs in Chinese in part of the city and in Spanish in part of the city. That, you know how many street signs there are and how many Hispanics there are in places like Miami and LA, and also, of course, Asians and Indians and other things. So we're increasingly diverse,
anyway,
obviously.
Diversity, racial diversity and ethnic diversity in our country is an enormous strength and gift. I mean, it's the idea that people would be frightened of it. It's just too bad. It's just like people are living, you know, I mean, they just don't get out enough or something, you know, or they're living in the wrong place. But, you know, I mean, it is what makes us really, truly a great country.
Yes, and we all benefited by it, too. I mean, my grandparents came here from East Europe, and probably yours did, too.
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, everyone did, you know. So, yeah.
Where did yours come from? Ireland, perhaps?
Ireland, England, Switzerland, and Germany.
Well, those countries are fighting also, especially Germany and Switzerland, at the borders and with immigration from the east and et cetera. It's very, France has a huge reaction to that, and, you know.
Yeah, well, we've
Marie
been spending
Le Pen,
a lot of time in France, you know, so.
Yeah, the very far right wing people.
Well,
know,
we,
Le
thought,
Pen
we,
has
thought
like
that, 20%. We thought it was pretty far right wing with Marine Le Pen, and then we see what, you know, the alt-right is doing here, and it doesn't.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not any different, really. And
right,
in
exactly.
fact, it seems to be maybe the numbers are even bigger here than in France. I mean, that's what's been very helpful, that all this gets exposed, that it's not just mm-hmm. happening in some sort of weird part of the internet,
yeah.
you know, that
yes.
people really understand that there really is a real, you know, major right-wing, you know, coalescing here around a lot of unfortunate issues. And, you know, now I think people see it more. Anyway, we were talking about the sort of universal aspects of, you know, that we recognize in people, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm finding that that's really, I mean, what I'm doing with these pilgrimage films, what and this current one that I'm working on, ultimately is really about the fact that every human being is born a pilgrim in this life,
mm-hmm.
you know, walking on their own spiritual path.
Right. Life is like a pilgrimage.
It is a pilgrimage.
And we're all pilgrims of seekers.
And seekers. What I found in India, which was interesting, is that, you know, India, even with all of the caste system and the social hierarchies that exist in India.
Yeah. And the poverty.
This, on Yatra, everybody is equal. I mean, everybody's mm-hmm. a Yatri.
Yeah.
which is a name for pilgrim.
Like in the subway.
And at least by tradition, mm-hmm. everybody is equal.
Right, theoretically.
And that got me feeling like, why don't we think more like this as human beings? You know, why don't we think more that, we didn't ask to be born. We just arrived here. We're here, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so is everybody else. Everybody sort of spontaneously arose here. Mm-hmm. And each of us is walking our own path in life. And what a remarkable thing to share.
Right. I mean, walking together, whether we think that way or not. I mean, people feel alone and lonely, but we're alone together.
But, you know, when you see yourself as a pilgrim, you see everybody else as mm-hmm. Same regard. And that sort of changes the way. And then everybody has a certain nobleness about mm-hmm. their lives. It doesn't matter what their function is in life.
No.
The fact that everybody's trying to solve the same riddle.
Right. And everyone has
the mortal and the eternal.
Right. Everyone has a greater destiny, whatever it's called, however it's conceived of. And we're all on that, like you said, great vehicle or great highway path together.
Yeah.
So I hope you're talking like this in your new film. This is a beautiful theme for today.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Oh, thanks, Surya.
This is a great theme for today.
We've been having this conversation for a long time.
Yeah. Well, now having it on Skype, we've teched up.
I love it.
It's nice to see you, literally. It's nice to see you. I haven't seen you in a month since the feast at the farm. Yes.
Yeah, no, I think the other thing that is, I think, the difference is feeling yourself. See, I don't know. You know, I was thinking if everybody's on a spiritual path through life, but many people don't realize it, mm-hmm. that's probably okay too.
That's okay.
I mean, you know, because my liver is functioning just fine, and I'm not consciously controlling it. I don't know anything about it, really. You know. And it's so important to my survival.
Yes.
But it's ongoing, just as like the life story, our life experiences teach us continually all the time, right? All of these things mm-hmm. about compassion and empathy, you know.
Yes, especially if we attend to them and learn from experience, don't just rush on to the next ones mindlessly. I'm liking thinking about, you know, the path train and we're all on this pilgrimage together in life and how we need each other to become enlightened and to love and learn to love and open and not just think and educate our minds, but awaken our hearts. And it's a beautiful image for today. And to go further, I'm thinking it is true we're all on the spiritual path, and so many people don't know it or don't believe it or acknowledge it. That doesn't matter, as you were just saying. And in fact, if God became visible, he or she would be invisible, which is the case.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, like the liver is functioning, if it's not giving any trouble, that's good.
That's
if it's
good.
Invisible to us.
That's good.
It only becomes visible when it's rattling, like the broken part of the car. Starts to rattle. So it is invisible to most of us, but it doesn't mean it's not there.
I see a lot of people who really are very evolved and conscious human beings, and they're not self-consciously spiritual. Mm-hmm. In fact, probably most of them would consider themselves agnostics or maybe atheists
or humanistic.
No. But you know, life has its way of shaping us up. You know, I mean, it's designed that way, right? So it's unautomatic. I just love reflecting on it. I don't know. Well, for me, you feel pulled. I had to solve the riddle myself. I was pulled to India, and I was pulled to those experiences that we shared there. I couldn't remain passive in the middle of all of the mm-hmm. stuff that was going on that we knew at that time in the 60s, for example, you know.
Yes, it was the 60s. It was a big turning over of the garden and a big awakening.
Yeah.
And like an exponential leap, not just a little incremental progress.
Mm-hmm.
So that reminds me, I think the first pilgrimage that I was consciously on was with you and Mirabai and my travel buddy, Ken Humphreys, and we met in Kashmir, and hiked for 8 or 9 days up above the snow line and over the Mahagunas Pass. It was like 10 or 12,000 feet. I think we were in sandals.
It's 16,000 feet.
16,000 feet, unbelievable. Yeah. And to that cave, Amarnath Cave, where there's the full moon ice lingam or phallus that they worship in Amarnath Cave. And it's a stalagmite growing up from the ground that they consider Shiva's phallus or lingam. And that was my first pilgrimage.
It's an ice lingam. It's created from the ground.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Surya, you know, at this point, because of global warming, that phenomenon is really more of more legendary than a reality.
I didn't know that. There's no more ice lingam.
Yeah,
growing
the glaciers are melting,
floor
and,
every
the,
year.
And the caves are the cave, the Amarnath Cave, where we went, which is where actually that's where. Shiva told Parvati the secrets of the universe in that cave. That's in Hinduism, its purpose.
I think we heard some of them there, if you remember, but I don't remember what they were. But it certainly helped. And so that was my first pilgrimage ever, and it was with you, Baba. So
well, thank you.
And we're still on the pilgrimage together, and you're even making art and teaching expressions for that, the films and other things that you've done. That was 1971, so it seems a long time. It's nice that we're still on the path, or even just alive and comrades and Dharma brothers together. It's beautiful. It's really, I'm grateful.
Yeah. Well, that was a wonderful pilgrimage we went on.
Yeah.
I remember coming back. This was the image that stuck with me. I remember we were walking back on this long path, and we were almost back to Palgam where we had started out.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I saw these guys. They were all running at us, and they were like, yelling and stuff like that. I had no idea what
remember.
They were doing,
yeah.
right?
Uh-huh.
And we just kept walking, and in about, like two more steps, we heard this giant explosion, and all of these giant boulders were flying around us. We walked into a blast site.
Oh, yes, the army was blasting or something.
And somehow we just walked through it and nothing happened.
We were blessed. We were graced. We were young. I mean, I was 20 years old. I didn't know which end was up.
I was 27 then, yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic.
You were 20, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I just graduated from college. I was 20. It was summer 1971. Mm. Yeah, I'm grateful. I'm glad I had an early start into this.
Yeah, work. I had heard about Amarnath from this sadhu who we were hanging out with in Jagashwar, and he was on his I was talking about the fact that the monsoon was coming, and he said, "Oh, well, he usually goes up to Amarnath at that time. He goes up to Kashmir because there's no mm-hmm. monsoon there." And that's right. How we met. Well, the rest of India was all deluged. It was still beautiful and dry mm-hmm. up there.
Yes, very dry. So do you go to India every year or two on pilgrimage, and including filming or photographing or scripting?
Well, I really hadn't been. I hadn't been to India in quite a long time, until I started making this film. And then, now I've spent about maybe 6 to 8 months there over altogether, shooting mm-hmm. the film and going on pilgrimage. Actually, with my two Indian crew members, we were shooting our own pilgrimage as we went, mm-hmm. So, but it was remarkable. It was so different than India when I had known it, when we were
yes.
there. I mean, when we were
right.
there, I mean, in 1971, the British had only left 22 years before. Okay? I mean,
That's hard to remember now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now India is completely, that's way past. And, they're soon to be the largest country in the world in a few more years. They will surpass China as far as population, half the country is under 25.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
But it sure has changed, with technology and digitization and outsourcing, and everybody has a cell phone. You remember when we were there, there was almost no phoning. You had to go to the post office to make a national
phone. Yeah, yeah, no, it was not even a possibility.
There was no TV. There was no radio much.
Yeah, now everybody has television.
Right.
There.
And the
I guess
internet.
Everywhere in the world, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. Interestingly, my Buddhist friends in Bhutan said they just got television like 15 years ago, and they still only have two or three channels in that tiny Himalayan country.
Yeah, happiness capital of the world.
Yeah, right, exactly. It is beautiful and it is green. It's like Switzerland of Asia. Yeah, right next to Nepal. So what are you doing now these very days, this autumn?
Well, right now I'm basically finishing the edit of the film, you know, and so I'm kind of immersed in India, you know, like 8 to 10 hours a day. My face was right there, reliving and re-experiencing these things and trying to make sense of it for the viewer. So that part I'm loving, actually, you know, to sort of keep.
Go through that.
Keep there. And then
video.
I'm sort of surprised when I come out. I'm still in New York.
I'm still here. You know, Broadway.
It really feels like it's something different than that. But yeah, but it's also, you know, it's, I'm continually asking on behalf of my future audience what this really means. I mean, what does it mean for the audience? I mean, yeah. I know what it means for the people we're seeing on screen.
No, but what's meaningful to us and the audience now?
Yeah.
And, you know, tomorrow.
So those are different things, you know, and also, you know, I feel an indebtedness to India, and I feel I want to, I mean, from what I experienced there, and as I'm sure you do, I mean, it was a unique possibility for us and for many, many people. And so I really want to appreciate India in that way. And I think it's kind of lost. I was really surprised. You know, when I did these other three pilgrimage films in Southeast Asia and Tibet, I saw how all these new spiritual concepts and practices from India were really transforming the world, you know. And I mean, over there, transformed. I mean, this is 1,000 years ago. I'm sorry.
Yes,
I'm
transformed
talking about
that side
how
of the
those
world.
Countries becoming Buddhist and Hindu countries in Southeast Asia and in Tibet, and then the synthesis that they created out of it, you know, went all the way to Japan, to, you know, to Mongolia. I mean, it transformed that entire part of the world, you know, and to this day. And now we have hundreds of millions of people in the West who are doing yoga, who are doing, you know, meditation, who are doing, you know, Buddhist practice or bhakti yoga practice or things like this. And that's having a transformative effect at this time, you know, in the West. And no doubt about it, you know. But the question is, what's being lost, I would guess, you know, in the present translation?
Well, I was thinking about two things. One, as you were speaking, one is perhaps one doesn't have to travel that far for it anymore, and there are good places and teachers in the Western countries, some Asian teachers and some Westerners. And second, that what is, if it is being lost, and maybe every generation feels that the traditions are being lost, but traditions also evolve. So like when I go to India, I go to some of those places like Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha sat under the tree and got enlightened 2,600 years ago, or the great stupa monument in Kathmandu Valley in Bodhinath, the Tibetan refugee village. These are some of my favorite pilgrimage places. Or Benares along the Ganges, where everybody bathes every morning and is doing yoga, and there's 24 hours chanting, and it's a little chaotic, but it's really like a spiritual festival constantly, day and night, like a Woodstock festival of spiritual practice day and night. So it seems like Benares is on the grid, and a lot of people have cell phones and iPads, and, you know, some even have cars and refrigerators. But the Ganges and the place where they burn the bodies, and the sadhus, the wandering ascetics and yogis, holy men, holy women, it hasn't changed. And Bodh Gaya is spread out and built up, and there are fences and security gates. But when you're in the sanctum, it hasn't changed. And the timeless goes on, even though time changes and evolves. So I hope that the roots continue to flourish, and we don't just pull the thing up and leave the roots behind and just have a short-lived plant or flower.
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly something that's coming forward in your teachings. You know, it's just how to adapt it to a contemporary how to adapt these teachings to a contemporary time. You know, so I mean, I know you and you know many other people I respect. That's what the work is right now. Right. But I do feel I am a little concerned about you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, that somehow in wanting to be more efficient by using, you know, mindfulness or something like this, or, you know, it just feels like there's really no substitute for deep practice. I mean, if you're one of those people that wants to be more self-conscious about your own spiritual life,
right?
You know, I mean, again, we said maybe you don't need to be. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people that seem to be doing it without that. But if that's the path you're upon, you know, the path of yoga or something else like that, it's really a lot more deep than, you know, people, I think, feel imagine. Comfortable in teaching it. I mean, I go to a yoga class. We stay, you know, here at the health club, right? And people, we start and end with Om. Mm-hmm. But there's a self-conscious determination to sort of keep it as secular as possible.
Yes.
And with good reason. I think that's fine.
Right.
I'm not interested.
No, it is fine.
But that's not really the classic. That's not really the classical yoga. I mean, the idea of Hatha Yoga was that it was these series of practices that would open you up so that then you could go more deeply into the rest of your spiritual practice. It was assuming that Hatha Yoga was only part of your spiritual practice. It wasn't a complete practice in itself, because I don't really think anybody can say that it is.
Well, it's part of the eight-limbed yoga, and there's also the wisdom yoga, meditation yoga, energy yoga, right? Devotional yoga, good service or karma yoga. So it's part of it. So just like mindfulness just for efficiency, something is lost in the spiritual benefits. Yoga just to look good or for health is losing. I mean, it's good in itself. It is what it is. But lacking sometimes the possible spiritual benefits, since the word yoga means union, and obviously it's about unifying with God or living, coming closer to oneness and less feelings of separation and loneliness and egotism.
Absolutely. Very well said. Yeah, so anyway, like for example, I mean, all of those practices, yoga, you know, mindfulness, you know, bhakti yoga, chanting, all bring you intensively into the present moment, okay? I mean, that's what's the beautiful thing. That's what they're designed to do, to bring you into the moment. But what do you do when you're in that moment? You know, I mean, when you're brought fully into the moment, what's the next step, you know? And I think that's what's not necessarily being conveyed, you know, because I think probably it sounds too religious to people or something. I mean, it's mistaken as religion, and it's not really the situation.
Well, it's universal truth, which is hard to define, but, you know, it's that kind of ideal. It's kind of a placeholder, words like that. But why don't you ask that question again? When you're in the moment, then what next?
Yes, when you're in the moment, you're standing at the you've been fully brought into the moment through mindfulness or from yoga or whatever. You're fully present. You're at the doorway. You've been brought to the door. What do you do to go through the door?
Be present to the next moment. And the next moment. Even without knowing, and because it's in a different dimension.
When you say be present, it sounds so easy when you say that, sir.
It's a lot.
Right?
I'm just saying I don't think it's impossible. That, since you were saying when you get to that moment, so what's next? So be present again, or if you lose it, come back to that, the same process that brought you present, your practice.
I've been working more in the sort of Hindu metaphors of because of this film I'm working on, and because it's sort of like this sort of, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing. I guess we should just say that we've had this interesting blend of both Hindu and Buddhist teachings, and they're part of that we've been trying to integrate. At least I have, and I know you have been trying to integrate both of these things, not feeling that they're oppositional at all, but very complementary ways of being, you know. But they do have different vocabularies at times, you know, so I'm using a different vocabulary now than my Buddhist vocabulary, you know. So
give us a metaphor. How do you see it?
Well, this is maybe a more universal language. It's really, I feel like we have these two aspects of ourselves, the mortal and the eternal, right? The eternal aspect of ourselves, that we were born with these, you know, sort of, you know, whatever the Buddhist, I mean, you know, whatever the Buddhist term would be, a true nature or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, but that through the, by when we come into the present moment, we come into, there's no eternal without the present moment. Mm-hmm. You know, that is literally what the eternal is. It's an unending present moment, right? And so right. we come into that. And so we come into that present moment. What do we do then? You know, it's really in the pilgrimage tradition, that's the time when you just completely open yourself and go into the eternal. You're it's a passage, you know, from mm-hmm. the small, let's say the small self to something much mm-hmm. bigger, mm-hmm. you know. Okay.
That's beautiful vision. That sounds very true.
Valid. Yeah. Yeah. And so I think I really feel like that's the pilgrimage that everybody is on in life. I mean, if we need to talk about it in some terms, it's that going from the eternal, you know, from the mortal to the eternal. I mean, we keep flipping back and forth in these things, you know, and I think we were much more overdeveloped on the mortal side, which yes. is the human side, right. you know, the individual side.
Right.
And the eternal is something that's much more. In the background. It's truly in the background, but it is
on the back burner.
It is.
We're burning on the front burner.
It is also a place that's animating us. Right. You know, we're yeah. those are the bigger wheels that are turning.
It's the hand inside the Muppets that we are. The one hand inside the different finger puppets that we are. Because we're all God's pseudopods, just appendages, but connected. Well, it's a beautiful vision, and that's a way, you know, as we say in Tibetan Buddhism, to see the Buddha or see the light in everyone and everything. So you have natural empathy, natural compassion, and treat them as you would be treated. See the Buddha in everyone and everything, not just human beings. Of course, that's a great way of relating to nature and animals and the interconnectedness of all things. As well, and
well,
I think it's so important
today.
I think
that was the thing that I got most out of Buddhism, and I think Hinduism got the most out of Buddhism. You know, it's interesting because there really isn't a lot of Buddhism in India anymore. But I'm finding the ways in which Buddhist values, because it was even the state religion of India for centuries, yes. so it's come into the whole culture. You know,
right.
Whether you want to believe that Buddha was the 10th incarnation of Vishnu or not, I mean, it doesn't. You know, that's like. For theologians to figure out, but literally that the idea of beingness and stuff like that, I feel like it came out of Hinduism to the Buddha and has come back into Hinduism from Buddhism, and I feel like that was the thing that was one of the most interesting discoveries for me. There was the idea of being, you know, that you know, and that. And in the film, what I'm really trying to talk about is the idea that we have these two aspects of ourselves, the mortal and the eternal. And I would call that the human and the being, you know, mm-hmm. that all human beings, we have both of these things. The human is the individualistic, you know, the individual. And the being is the shared.
Right. The transpersonal. Spirit.
Huh?
The transpersonal.
Like
the personal yeah. mortal one that dies and the transpersonal.
Yeah.
The underlying continuity.
I'm trying not to use deistic.
Yeah, I know. I hear you.
Here,
I know. You're avoiding the words like soul or self, but it's okay. We're just talking here in English. We're not theologians.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but it also gets in the way of people thinking
yes,
about it.
Right.
I don't think anybody can doubt the fact that we are called human beings. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay. I mean, that is our identity as a species,
yes,
right?
Yes, Homo sapiens.
So in that sense, as beings, we connect, just as you were saying, to other life forms, to animals and things like that, because we are beings. And so we recognize them as other beings. I remember you and Chandi, you know,
your
beautiful dog. You know, I mean, that was the perfect, you were two old souls together.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You know, so, but anyway, I keep trying to think of ways of being able to universalize this kind of stuff and simplify it. And mm-hmm. I feel what could be simpler than a human being, okay? But we're way over involved on the human side, on the individual side. You know, I'm the kind of person that likes purple. I'm the kind, you know, whatever it is. And especially with this world, It's gotten a lot more.
Looking at screens all day.
Yeah. Especially, you have a profile, you're putting out who you are, you're very consciously creating an identity for yourself online. Right. So that's all in the human side, which that's wonderful. There's nothing wrong with that, but it has to be balanced by the beingness, right. The contemplative aspect of ourselves, the eternal part of ourselves. Right. And that's what being on pilgrimage does, and that's what being on the path does,
Well, I think of it as where our society seems to be a little lacking in interiority. You know, obviously, when we're so outwardly oriented. It's like what you're talking about, pilgrimage. When you go to these sacred sites or spaces, and it doesn't have to be in the East, it could be anywhere. Like I was in Chartres in France, and I couldn't believe inside how marvelous and mystical it is. But still, in the sacred space, the inside is vaster than the outside that's around it. It's a different quality. That's more the eternal or infinite dimension, not just the personal or the time-bound or the quantitative. It's a whole different experience. It kind of your mind stops maybe.
Well, it's just something that's even in Ecclesiastes. It says, you know, that he has put the eternal on every heart. You know. I mean, everybody has that within them, mm-hmm. that eternal being is in every human being, you know, and so it's something that we can appreciate in each other. It's something that we sell, and nobody has to achieve anything. It's mm-hmm. already, it's indwelling, right. It's intrinsic. Yes. You don't have to, we can cultivate it so that we can make it more real in our lives, but everybody's carrying it around inside them already, you know?
Well, that's a beautiful vision. That's a great place to complete, I think, our pilgrimage today. The pilgrimage we've been on for 45 years together and probably longer. In this life or other lives or in other forms, who knows? Maybe Chandi, my beloved dog, was part of it, or, you know, yours, or who knows?
Yeah, well, Surya, I just have to say, it's just been so wonderful to watch you. Are we really out of time right now? Or
no, we can say a few more things, no problem.
Okay, but I remember in Bodhgaya, in Kashmir, when I was going through this Goenka retreat, and I was telling you about it, and you hadn't done any you had done some meditation, I think, with Philip Kaplow, but right. And I was telling you about this, like 12 hours a day, meditating, silence, monastery, and stuff like that.
10 days.
And I was saying, can we, why don't you come? I said, I'll give you, and you said, oh no, I don't think I could do that. It sounds way too much for me,
I remember.
And I said, well, let me give you the address just in case, And so I gave you the address in Rajasthan, a long way from Kashmir,
right?
And then I got there, and you were already there. I had to retreat.
Ken and I decided that we were crazy to stay up in the mountains trying to meditate and, doing other things. And instead, so we flew part of the way to not be late.
Oh, yeah,
that's how we got there. You probably went there by bus and train. It took two or three days.
Yeah. But anyway, then you started, really getting deeply involved in mm-hmm. practice and in teachings and stuff like this. But then I remember after your first 3-year, 3-month retreat that you did, that's meditating for 3 years, 3 months, people, that you came to Cambridge where I was living, and we were watching the NBA finals, which was one of your loves, and you hadn't uh-huh. seen any basketball, I guess.
I think I came with Chaitanya from Vermont. Yeah. To your house in Arlington on Spy Pod.
Oh, okay. And I remember asking you, because during halftime, we were sort of chatting. I said, so what do you think you're going to do now, Surya, that you've done your three-month retreat? And you said, I'm actually thinking about another one. And I was like floored, And you did. You actually did another one,
It was great. What else was there to do?
Anyway, I just found it so. From a guy who, I don't know about that. To
10 days, for 3 years.
To the level of practice that you've done, it's remarkable. Honestly,
it's a path. Talk about staying on the path and keep going. Continuity is the secret of success, as our teacher Goenka used to say.
Yeah, that's true.
Not getting elated or depressed about what's happening today, but keep going together, practicing and loving and opening and exploring the mystery.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. Okay, well, let's end it there.
Okay. Thank you very much, John Krishnabush. We look forward to seeing your films and re-seeing your Yatra trilogy and online.
Pictures. Let me just give a little, yes. If anybody's interested in seeing my films, you can go to directpictures.com/films.
Very good.
Directpictures.com/films. And yeah, they're all there, you know?
Yeah, isn't that great? What a resource. You can go on pilgrimage with us. Please join. Please.
Wonderful.
Okay. And so this is Our Awakening Now podcast on the Be Here Now network. And Lama Surya Das signing off. I also have social media and so on if you're interested. Love to one and all. Thank you.
Thank you, Surya.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.